from the Sky News Centre at 5. A couple entrusted by a mother to look after her three-year-old have been found guilty of murdering him. Ryan Lovell Hancock died in hospital on Christmas Eve 2008 after suffering horrific injuries at the hands of Christopher Taylor and Kayleigh Boleyn in Bilston in the West Midlands. Wolverhampton City Council's conducting a serious case review after it emerged a housing officer saw him hours before his death. Roy Lockwood's Director of Childcare and Young People Services.
Ryan was not subject to a child protection plan. Nonetheless, all the agencies in the city are determined to learn what lessons there are to be learned to ensure that no child ever dies in such circumstances in our city again.
The family of a mother whose doctors refused to believe had cancer has received an out-of-court settlement of £330,000. Lavinia Bletchley was sent home from Bridgend's Princess of Wales Hospital three times before she died from an aggressive form of the disease. Police have described the fatal stabbing of a 15-year-old boy at a busy London tube station as a reckless act of violence. Detectives are questioning 20 youngsters over the attack at Victoria yesterday evening. The US and American presidents have agreed a landmark treaty to slash their nuclear arsenals by a third. The deal will be signed next month in Prague. Gordon Brown insists expanding Heathrow Airport is still the right decision, despite campaigners claiming a major legal victory. The High Court's ruled plans for a third runway must be looked at again, particularly in respect of climate change. But Transport Minister Paul Clark says the policy is far from being in tatters.
We know that Heathrow is 99% full. That's costing UK PLC, businesses, people wanting to go on holiday and so on, time and money. And we need to recognise that Heathrow is an international hub airport, which is good for the UK.
Countdown is celebrating its 5,000th episode. More than 50 series have been broadcast since its debut in 1982, when it was hosted by the late Richard Whiteley and Carol Vorderman. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
BCFM is a community radio station for Bristol.
So what exactly does that mean?
Well, it means that anybody can get involved in any way you want.
Yeah, but what if you haven't done radio before?
That doesn't matter, because BCFM have qualified tutors that run training courses that tell you everything you need to know.
To find out more information, go to www.bcfm.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Mondays at 5, it's Tom Bigwood. Tuesdays, it's Dan and Laura. Wednesdays, Ryan and Sam. Thursdays, it's Phil Gibbons. But Fridays... Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling. And our guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Chair of Bristol City Council's Licensing Committee and Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Mary Sykes. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too, as usual. No Vox Pops this week, but we hear from John and Malcolm McNamara from Westbury. They say Bristol City Council's independent living service have been penny-pinching, putting delays of years on simple aids and adaptations, leaving many of their elderly tenants at risk. And after the 6 o'clock news, Dr. Alan Sabrowski is an ex-senior US Marine Corps officer, the retired head of studies at the US Army's War College. He's been on the radio in the United States this week saying the Israeli Mossad carried out the 9/11 attacks. So what exactly did he say and why? Then we take a look at the Irish Troubles and collusion between secretive units in the British Army with loyalist terrorists. Montpellier-based ex-soldier Bryn Richard Cowley reports. And is our economic and military crisis part of a calculated push for world government? Argentinian analyst and economist Adrian Salbucci believes powerful operators behind the scenes have been quietly planning a world government for nearly 100 years. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, averaging 10 degrees Celsius, a little bit warmer, isn't it? Sunny on Saturday, a mixture of sunny spells and rain on Sunday. Next week, averaging around 6 degrees in the daytime. Plenty of showers this week, but with some sunny spells. Some snow or sleet is possible around Tuesday. next weekend, which is the 3rd and 4th of April, that's Easter weekend, averaging 3 degrees Celsius in the daytime. Relatively cloudy weekend, it's a lot colder, with a few sunny spells and even possible light snow on Saturday afternoon. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and joining us is Chair of Bristol City Council Licensing Committee and Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Mary Sykes. Well, welcome to Drive Time, Mary.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, are you from Bristol?
No, I'm not a Bristolian. I've now lived here 25 years. So.
And where are you from?
Well, I actually come from Middlesex, from Sunbury-on-Thames.
Okay, so. And are you retired? Did you have a profession?
Yes, I'm retired. I worked in the water industry, which is... And I was working for Wessex Water, and I came to Bristol as a result of one of their reorganisations.
And was that before it was privatised?
That was before it was privatised. When it was privatised, I went to the National Rivers Authority.
Okay, now the cabinet system, which is used in most cities and probably all cities in the country now, what are your thoughts on the cabinet system, as you probably have experienced before it was a cabinet system?
Yes,
as well.
My first couple of years or so on the council, it was the old committee system. Well, it does rather drive a wedge. Well, so we always say a wedge. There's the executive and the cabinet, and then there's everybody else who tries to do their bit, but you know, only has a fairly limited influence.
So what about you? Have you ever been on the cabinet, or have
I've always been a backbencher.
Okay. Now, which other committees are you on apart from the licensing, chairing licensing?
I'm on the South and East Planning, and I'm on the other licensing committee, which is Public Safety and Protection, and I also sit on the Health Scrutiny Commission and the Quality of Life Scrutiny Commission.
So is your licensing committee just dealing with bar licences and that kind of thing?
Virtually all licensed.
Okay.
The alcohol and licensing side of the city, yes.
Okay, so what about newspapers? What do you have a favourite daily newspaper?
You don't
have to say the Evening Post. I mean a national paper, really.
Well, I must admit, I don't actually take a national paper.
Do you have a favourite paper, though?
Probably the Independent, I would have said.
Okay.
But I do take the Evening Post.
Now, Martin Summers is here, too. He's our old Labour economics expert, Oxford economist and pundit. Martin, I'm going to pin you down this week on this Robin Hood tax we keep hearing about. What is the Robin Hood tax? And the big question about this is, could the UK actually go it alone, or would we have to negotiate with other countries in order to bring something like this in?
Well, what's been called the Robin Hood tax was originally thought up by a US economist in the 1970s called James Tobin. So it's called the Tobin tax. And, of course, if you change T to R, it becomes the Robin Hood tax, if you like. The idea was that every financial transaction should carry a very small tax. And the idea of this is to kind of throw sand in the wheels of the financial markets, just to slow them down just a tiny bit. And because there's so many financial transactions in the modern world, it would be a very lucrative tax very quickly. And then that money could be used for whatever you wanted to use it for. You could buy nuclear bombs with it if you wanted to. But in actual fact, what Tobin suggested was that that money should be used for international development, for poverty relief. And, of course, this idea seems to have got some steam up in recent months because of all the questions about trying to reform the financial system. I mean, personally, I would be in favour of such a tax. Jeffrey Sachs, who's a US economist of some standing, although I'm not actually a great fan of his, he said that we shouldn't be cutting public expenditure either in Britain or the US. We should bring in a tax of this kind and therefore raise enough money to plug the hole in the public finances. And of course, you can imagine how that goes down on Wall Street and in the City of London. But they're not so popular these days as they used to be, those chaps.
Yes, but you haven't answered my question, have you? Which is, could we do it alone in the UK, or would we have to negotiate?
Jeffrey Sachs said, if the US won't agree to do it, you should go it alone. And I think that would be a nice, brave thing for Britain to do. We're the second most important financial centre in the world, in the City of London. If we chose to do it, it would have a big impact. And of course, we would raise a lot of money by doing it, which we could then plug the hole in the public finances with. So from my point of view, it would be a win-win. But of course, you can see that the Labour government actually lacks conviction in these matters. They're very, very, they're very kind of, what's the word? They're very timid when it comes to dealing with these matters.
Now, Mary, the Lib Dems have got quite a lot of credibility through Vince Cable, who's been very quite articulate.
Yes.
We've had him complimented quite a lot on this show as one of the most articulate people in explaining the economic situation. What's your thoughts on this idea of a Robin Hood tax? It does sound to me a little bit like a kind of buzzword, isn't it? You can't really be against Robin Hood, could you?
Well, I think you could, but on the other hand, I can see, you know, some advantages in what Martin has just said. I must say I don't know a great deal about this particular tax.
Okay. Well, anyway, I'm going to, as we're coming in sort of in the run-up to the elections, I'm going to try a little experiment with you, Mary, if you don't mind. And that's
right.
I'm just going to ask you a bunch of questions, and I want to hear which way you would vote, one way or the other, for or against. First of all, the British occupation of Afghanistan.
Well, I think this is a very complex situation.
But if you had to vote, if you were sitting there in the and you had to vote one way or the other,
I would probably vote against.
Okay, and you can abstain if you want to. Yeah.
Right.
Extension of late bar licences. Now, there's a bit of a biased one for you from the licensing committee.
Well, yes.
How do you think it's all gone? Is it something you think there should be more of or less?
I'm a bit balanced. I mean, generally, I'm all for, you know, freedom of people to do what they like as long as they don't upset other people, but quite a lot of the late bar licensing probably does upset certainly the neighbours and you know, people, and encourages quite a lot of unruly behaviour.
So is that
the
against
city. So it probably is against.
Okay,
yes.
Next one, Trident nuclear submarines.
Trident,
because they're quite expensive, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I'm against those. Yes.
Okay,
yes,
Bristol City Stadium on the Greenbelt.
Well, I actually sat on the planning committee and voted for it, so...
Okay. And finally, cuts in public services, are they necessary now?
Well, I think probably some are. Certainly, some should definitely be...
So it sounds to me like you're voting for that one.
Yes.
Okay, thanks very much for that. Anyway, let's move on to have a look at some of this week's stories anyway. And we're starting this week with the financial services agency, Dawn Raids, Rock City Institutions. This was a story from Tuesday. Three prominent financial institutions, Deutsche Bank, BNP Paribas and Moore Capital, were on Tuesday embroiled in the UK's biggest insider dealing case yet after Dawn Raids at 16 locations led to the arrests of six people. More than 140 officers from the Financial Services Authority swooped on premises across London and the South East, seizing documents and computers from Deutsche and BNP's UK headquarters, as well as Mayfair-based Moore Capital. Three city professionals, including senior executives at Deutsche Bank and BNP, and a trader at Moore Capital, were among those arrested on suspicion of being involved in what the FSA called a sophisticated and long-running insider dealing ring. Now, this is the sort of thing, Martin, that you've been calling for over the last few months, saying that actually that some of the insider dealing is actually fraudulent, and you were asking questions about why there wasn't more action. So it seems like you've got your way here to a certain extent.
Well, I mean, obviously one doesn't want to judge a particular case. I mean, people are innocent till proven guilty. But certainly there's been an awful lot of fraud as part of this bubble. And one of the ways to get our money back, if you like, is simply to prosecute the fraudsters and get the money back off them. And that's another way to fill the hole in the public finances.
Mary, what are your thoughts on this one? Are you glad to see some action against insider dealing?
Well, yes, I would certainly think that it is a good thing to make an example of certain people. Yes.
Okay, and the other point adjoining this is the end of the line for the rail firm Jarvis, because apparently one of these firms that's been doing insider dealing is also connected with rail maintenance, and yet Jarvis, the firm that was apparently involved in one of these rail crashes, has finally gone bankrupt. Do you think that there are enough safeguards, both of you, I'll let either of you chip in on this one, are there enough safeguards on these big public contracts? Because it does seem that potentially there may have been some brown envelopes passing around, and maybe that some of these big government contracts, there's so much at stake that it's very difficult to be sure that the contracts are being awarded fairly.
Well, obviously, one has to have a transparent system for awarding government contracts, and people have got to know what's going on. I think one of the things that highlights for me is how much so-called private sector activity is ultimately funded by the taxpayer. You know, Jarvis is supposedly an independent private company, but in actual fact, if you analyse it, most of its most of its custom comes from the government. And the same would be true of all the arms industry factories in Bristol, which employ so many people. They're not private sector companies, although private profits are taken. Ultimately, they're there because taxpayers, in their wisdom, have allowed their representatives to spend money on those things. But it's, but to call this the free market is, to my mind, stretching a point.
I think I'd agree with Martin there. I have, yes, certainly, I mean, we've got Jarvis who has the contract, but we don't really know about, you know, the people who may have you know, quoted for it and were turned down, you know, whether they would have been just as, you know, either clean or not, as well, the case may be.
Do you think there's enough accountability when it comes to awarding these contracts, including those with the council here? These big public contracts, because it just seemed to me sometimes that these big pots of public money are sort of somewhat unguarded, and there's not enough. There's not the same kind of vociferous defending of that cash as if it was, say, people's personal cash or private cash, because it's seen as public cash, and a lot of people have got their fingers in the pie. Is that exaggerating? So really what I'm saying is, are these contracts the contracts that are being awarded by the council, do you think that they're open enough and accountable enough?
Well, there are certainly fairly strict rules on procurement within the council, and I would think so, although there is always a sort of, not that I've had anything really to do with many, awarding many contracts, but there seems to me to be a slight thing about, you know, confidentiality over the money on the side, which means that perhaps certain things are not made as public as they might have been in the first thing.
If I can just pick up on that, well, that is probably the most pernicious aspect of public contracting, is that a lot of what's going on is commercially confidential. Now, I can't see how we can ask taxpayers, citizens, to commit their resources to any proposal which is confidential. I mean, that's a recipe for malfeasance, in my view. And if private sector companies don't want exposure, then they shouldn't bid for those contracts. I mean, transparency should be part of the, you know, you've got to tell us exactly what you're putting in and what we're putting in. And obviously, one of the worst examples of this was Gordon Brown forcing the Metronet contract on London Underground against the wishes of Ken Livingstone. And of course, it all turned sour and cost millions. This obsession with having private finance, we've reached the point you feel like saying to the government, look, there is no private finance, there is none. So you're talking about having public private sector partnerships, but the private sector is bust. They haven't actually got any money, but we're still stuck in the old way of thinking. The government can't quite let go of this privatization ideology, even though it's over, because there is no private finance.
Okay, on to our next story, which is the big story of the week, supposedly, and that is the budget. Now it's class war, apparently, according to the Daily Mail, and the darling hammers the better off with tax rises, a stamp duty hike on £1 million homes, and a nasty surprise for Lord Ashcroft. Well, with just weeks to go, says the Mail, before Gordon Brown goes to the country and the Tories just ahead in the polls, the Chancellor set the stage for an election in which Labour will try to portray themselves as the party of the ordinary majority, while the Tories represent the super rich. The measures included stamp duty scrapped on homes up to £250,000. Homes worth £1 million or more are going to be hit by a 5% levy. 60% of tax rises are paid for by the top 5% of earners. No axe to public spending, but £11 billion in efficiency savings, duty on beer, wine and spirits, and cider, for some reason, rising 10% above inflation. Tobacco duty increased by 1% above inflation, then 2%. And finally, fuel duty rises staggered until next January. I think we probably better start with you, Martin, because you've been banging on about what you want done with the economy, and I've asked you several times, what would you do if you were Chancellor? How do you think Alistair Darling did this week?
I think he did reasonably well. I quite like the Daily Mail's take on this, that it's the government is trying to suggest that they are going to tax the rich and that the Tories won't tax the rich. I'm afraid a lot of that is huff and puff. They need to be much, as I said earlier, they are quite timid about all of this. Given the mood in the country, they could probably take a much stronger line than they are. But at least they're starting to point in the right direction. Yes.
And I don't think, I mean, obviously the Liberal Democrats have critiqued this. I think there's a bit of a competition between the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party to capture this public mood of, you know, determination that the wealthy must pay their way. And I welcome a consensus across the parties about that. The Conservatives, if they had any sense, would realise that that's what the country wants. And the fact that they don't realise that that's what the country wants is why they're languishing a bit. Because I don't think the people of this country want big cuts in public services so that the wealthy can carry on having their bonuses.
Right. Yeah, on the whole, I would agree with Martin on that. I must admit I haven't perhaps taken... looked at the budget in as much detail as especially as I knew I was coming on this programme as I might have done.
But there wasn't much in it, frankly.
No, right. I mean, but anything that helps helps the less well off as against the richer people, the richer section of the public, I think is a good thing.
So are you in favour of sort of new big taxes on the rich?
Well, I wouldn't. Within limits, yes.
Okay.
on that point, can I just say that the Liberal Democrats had a policy of a 50% top tax raise,
yes,
which they then triangulated themselves out of, and then the Labour Party said, "Ha ha ha, we're never going to do anything like that." And then, of course, they did do it, and it turned out to be popular. And yeah, you know, it's like this is staring us in the face. And it's, you can't raise income taxes beyond a certain point without creating problems. That's why you've got to start thinking about wealth taxes, property taxes. But we one of the problems is that the electoral system doesn't allow us to talk about those things because it's all pushed into the centre because of the two, you know, the Tweedledum Tweedledee effect, and therefore a proper case for proper tax rises never gets made.
Yes. What's the Tweedledee and Tweedledum effect, Martin?
Well, it's the Labour Tory duopoly problem. Yeah, so the Labour Party can't go too far, can't actually follow its own heart because it's got to actually win those marginal seats around London and so on. Whereas if you had a PR system, which I'm very much in favour of, then the Labour Party could concentrate on its core mission of mobilising and organising the underprivileged and speaking for them instead of, you know, triangulating into the centre and losing their orientation. And of course others will colonise that ground and perfectly happy for them to do that. But I think our destiny is where it's always been. It's behind the people at the bottom of the pile.
So I'm glad to hear, as a Lib Dem, that you're behind this Labour budget, Mary.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm totally behind the Labour budget, but...
Nick Clegg made perfectly good criticisms of the budget, didn't he?
Yes.
But, you know, it's all made in a spirit... I mean, we've all got to get serious about this situation. The country is a mess. And, you know, Yarboo simply won't cut it in this situation.
Well, David Cameron has been getting serious, and he was down in Bristol yesterday, the Conservative leader, answering questions from local residents at a primary school in North Bristol. As far as we can... When he was asked... This is it's from Jack FM's website, another radio station. When asked for his view on the 10% rise in tax on cider announced at the budget earlier this week, Mr. Cameron said he thought it was totally the wrong approach to tackling binge drinking. What I would do, he says, instead of the government's 10% across the board tax on cider, is recognise that some of these drinks, like White Lightning, which frankly has got no relation to Adnams, as far as I can see, at all, it's £3.99 for something that's about 8% strength proof. Nobody drinks this for fun. They drink it to get off their heads. Well, I would whack up the tax on that, and also, to an extent, on some of the Alco Pops. Let's go for the problem drinks and the problem drinkers and the problem establishments, rather than actually hitting everyone with a big tax on drinks when some people are just having a quiet drink in the pub or a quiet glass of wine at home. Now, as someone that's dealing all the time with alcohol licences, Mary, what are your thoughts about what David Cameron had to say last night?
Well, I think that, you know, It's easy to say things like that, but it is quite difficult to actually devise a scheme that would do it with any sort of sense.
As I understand it, originally, you know, at the moment, alcohol taxes are levied on differently on different strengths of alcohol. So I think what he's saying there is this cider, which is very high strength, he's talking about taxing that more than the ordinary strength cider.
Well, yes, I mean, I think that would be quite a quite a sensible idea. But I think a lot of the drinking problems now are because, you know, practically every corner shop, every news agents, as well as every supermarket, and the supermarkets probably have are responsible for a lot, have an off license, and therefore, you know, alcohol is so widely available that that it is very difficult to control the drinking habits of the population.
But isn't that your fault for handing out so many licenses?
Well, actually, the under the terms of the Licensing Act, we are very constrained about what we can and cannot do, and we have to have. In fact, you know, we can't even review a license unless somebody else asks us to.
So, do you find yourself quite often awarding licenses where, in your heart, you're thinking, "Well, this isn't probably such a good idea."
There have been odd occasions where, and as I say, I mean, the whole idea of the new licensing laws was to relax the licensing, the availability of alcohol, and you know, not to. The whole idea was that we wouldn't have places which threw out a finishing time for drinking in pubs, say, and clubs, so that. You know, the idea was that we wouldn't have everybody out on the street at the same time, but in actual fact, it tends to be going round in a sort of spiral. And as one premise asks for longer hours, then a month or two later, and the neighbouring premises all start asking for it, and we just get later and later comings out. And whether we get this staggered finish to drinking is problematic in certain areas.
So how does it actually work when you make a decision at your committee? Are you do you get advice from maybe officers in the council saying, well, this is what the law says, and
so you're given
a bit of a steer?
Oh, we are definitely given a bit of a steer. Our legal team are very strong, but we also have representations from people like environmental health and what have you about, you know, particularly if there's been a lot of noise complaints. And and then to be honest, it quite often comes down to a sort of almost bartering between the applicant and the complainants, and we try to come to a consensus that everybody is happy with.
So if there's anyone out there listening who's thinking, gosh, I'm living right next to some licensed premises which are causing me a real headache, and yet I don't think the council's listening, what should they do?
Well, what they should do is ask for a review, and which they are entitled to. People in the vicinity of a licensed premises are always entitled to ask for a review. It does help if they collect some evidence, you know, keep diaries of problems and if they can get the local police on their side, that all helps, because the police can also ask for reviews. But it is in the Act. Local people are allowed to ask for a review. And, you know, and the City Council, in fact, can't do anything until somebody asks for a review.
Okay. What about things like noise levels? How on earth can ordinary people out there just, you know, be expected to actually do measurements of noise levels? And do the council sometimes come in and do that for them?
Oh, they do sometimes come in and do that for them. You can always ring the council and ask for the noise people to come out.
Is that environmental health?
That's environmental health, yes.
Okay, well, we've had enough about that for the time being, but we're going now on to look at the Cash for Influence story, which was the Dispatches programme, which aired on Monday evening. I've decided to, because I'm a little bit sceptical, I don't know what you two think about whether this is really a big story or not, because these are all outgoing MPs, and one would have expected that's what outgoing MPs do, isn't it? That they're then trying to tout around to use their contacts that they've built up whilst being MPs to do lobbying in the future. What are both of your thoughts about this whole I don't know if either of you saw the Dispatches programme. You must have seen the coverage of it.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about whether it really is a big scandal or not?
Can I come in first? I mean, obviously, as a member of the Labour Party, I am not happy at all that these people are being caught out in this way. They're within the rules, as you say,
but that's not really the point. Politically, what does it say to the people we're trying to mobilise at the ballot box in a few weeks' time if our leaders are shown to be basically venal? And, obviously on this note, it's come out this week that that Tony Blair has made £20 million since he stopped being Prime Minister. I find that basically unacceptable. I think back to a previous generation of Labour leaders who lived in modest circumstances and were proud to lead from those modest circumstances. When John Smith was elected as Labour leader, he was a top barrister and he had Tory friends in the Parliament, and they said, "What on earth are you doing being Labour leader for £30,000 a year, John? You could be earning that, you know, in a couple of months in the High Court." And his response was, "You just don't get this, do you? It's an honour and a privilege to be in my position."
Yes, yes, I agree. I think the whole thing it brings politicians generally into disrepute. The number of people who say, "Oh, politicians are only in it for what they can get," is increasing all the time, and people are getting very turned off from politics, and that'll be one of the worst things that could happen. If the percentage of people voting in the general election goes down so low that it is not really a true reflection of the country's opinion.
Well, when I was looking through this, the coverage of this documentary, the thing that really stuck out for me was that Tesco has denied claims that the former government minister Stephen Byers managed to get food labelling laws watered down on its behalf. Mr. Byers was secretly recorded offering his services like a sort of cab for hire for up to £5,000 a day to a journalist posing as a member of a fictitious US company. In what has been labelled the Cash for Influence scandal, Mr. Byers gave examples of how he previously managed to lobby his former cabinet colleagues to assist major companies. He claimed he had phoned Business Secretary Peter Mandelson, who I saw on Newsnight this week, rather wriggling as he denied it, at the request of Tesco to ask him to put a stop to bureaucratic food labelling regulations, which, I mean, I think this is one of the most important things in the world. We need to have decent food labelling, especially since of all the additives and things like that go in food nowadays. Peter apparently got it delayed and then got it amended, Mr. Byers said to these investigative journalists. Tesco insisted the claims were false. "We did not speak to Mr. Byers about labelling, regulation, or indeed any other issue. These claims are completely fictitious. Mr. Byers has acknowledged this to us," a Tesco spokesman. Anonymous Tesco spokesman said. What are your thoughts about the actual sort of workings of this kind of thing? And Mr. Byers is making these claims to these journalists. Do you think they're true or not?
Well, I mean,
I was going to say, I don't think they're true. I mean,
do you think he was boasting?
Yes. I mean, I think he was touting for business, and he was trying to make out that he'd got more influence than in fact he actually had, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I think that's probably right. I think the real problem is how is the dividing line between money and politics. So we've had all this fuss about MPs' expenses. Meanwhile, the bankers, of course, are paying themselves loads of bonuses with our money. But also, of course, many MPs have outside interests. If I'm working for Bristol City Council, I'm not allowed to say I'm working 3 days a week as a director of something else. I've got a job for the council. But if you're an MP, you can have all sorts of outside interests and be an MP as well. And in the past, that was regarded as a kind of, well, we want men of the world to be MPs, so they've got to have all these other interests. But there really is a question, isn't there, of how much time you're actually spending on your political job when your main money is coming from sitting on the boards of various companies. And we've got to get dirty money out of politics. I mean, in Scandinavia, all political parties are funded by the state on the basis of the votes they scored at the last election. And that is the only money that they can spend on advertising, leafleting, what have you. And it makes it a lot cheaper and a much leveler playing field. Because we're getting tied up in knots now with the funding for our politics. Unite the Union, for example, having a strike at BA, but they're also major funders of our party. And that creates all sorts of problems.
Yes. No, I've lost my thread. Sorry.
Okay.
I was
Well, my point here really is just is essentially is about Tesco's, and it does worry me that groups like them have an immense amount of financial clout, fantastic amounts of money. I mean, for example, I had a Tesco lorry crash into the back of my car in May last year, and the barristers that they've set onto my insurance company are so powerful that I've now got a bill through for something like £6,000 to repair the front of their Tesco lorry. You know, this is the kind of thing that you think, well, actually they're too litigious and they're lobbying too much, and they seem to have a little bit too much power. I think particularly also with this whole issue of food labelling, things like food irradiation, a lot of stuff to do with genetically modified ingredients of food are still not properly labelled on the food that we're eating. And this was something I seem to remember, Martin, that it was the Labour government in the 70s that brought these a lot of these labelling legislation in. But of course this is inconvenient for the supermarkets. Anyway, I better get off my soapbox on that one, right, and move on to
I was going to go back to what Martin was saying about the MPs having second jobs, because, well, I mean, city council, quite a number of the city councillors have other jobs as well as being on the city council. But You do have to declare, you know, at frequent intervals if you have an interest in anything before, you know, it is very common. You know, practically every meeting somebody gets up and says, I work for, or even, I mean, when we had the stadium planning permission, we, you know, I and another councillor both stood up and said we were members of Avon Wildlife Trust, because they were one of the people who had objected, you know, so that...
So you say you might end up with some committee meetings with almost all of the committee members outside because they're
well,
have an interest.
Well, no, it depends. It depends how much they think it's going to influence you. If you're likely to have a direct financial interest in anything, then you do have to stand aside and everything.
And you
take no part in the discussion. In fact, in some things like planning, you even go outside the room and don't say, but but just being a member of a society doesn't impede you. You have to, you know, try and take a balanced view, and you know, not.
Is it not the case, Mary, that if you are a councillor, as you are, you've got certain definite hours that you are paid for, that you have to, you know, meetings that you have to attend, and so on?
Well, the only actual meeting you are expected to attend are the full council meetings, right, of which we only have about 8-9
so
a year.
So in other words, you could have a councillor who is drawing all of their pay and expenses but not turning up to anything. I mean, that does happen sometimes, I suppose.
It does happen from time occasionally, but they are not held in high regard by their fellow councillors.
Right. I think it's a shame, that because lots of people at that level are hard working, and basically they're doing it for love, not money, let's face it. And those people who are working in the community like that are let down by the people at the top of the tree, when you go out on the doorsteps, you're getting all this hostility from people, and you feel like saying, do you think I'm being paid to stand in the rain on this doorstep? Of course I'm not. And we've got to get people to respect political participation as an important civic duty, not as a way to line your own pocket.
Well, you need to clean up your political parties and make sure that the Stephen Byerses of this world aren't on the TV being exposed. Anyway, there's one last thing I'd like to talk about registers of members' interests. And I think I'm right in saying, Mary, that there is actually a register of all members' interests, the councillors at the City Council. If you actually go, I don't know if you can read it online, or do you have to actually
I think you can read it online. Yes, you can. I think if you go to the City Council.
If you're not online, you can just trot down to College Green, and I think it's probably just up until 4 o'clock in the afternoon weekdays. You can have a look through and see what the interests are, and if any of the councillors have any interests which they haven't declared, what happens to them then?
Well, they'd probably be holed up before the Standards Board. It would depend how heinous and how much effect. I mean, every now and again people join things and perhaps forget to add it to their members' interests, but
anyway, that's all there for public inspection if people want to, and apparently also on the internet. Well, it's 5:30 now, and time to, well, actually just nearly 22 minutes to 6, actually, and time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Mary Sykes' choice of music. So, Mary, what's the music and why did you choose it?
Well, it's the overture to Handel's Water Music, and I chose it partly because of my long association with the water industry, and but also it goes back even before that, because the Festival of Britain, I was in a pageant at Hampton Court, which is near where I grew up, and this was the sort of theme music to the pageant. It was about the history of Kingston, Twickenham and Richmond.
Listening to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. That was the overture to Handel's Water Music, chosen by today's guest on BCFM 93.2's Friday Drive Time, Lib Dem councillor from Hengrove, Mary Sykes. When someone is in council or housing association tenant and their health deteriorates, it often means that they have to move to an old people's home where they can have carers on hand 24 hours a day. But to save money, and if the tenant wants, the council can get a grant to adapt the property with alarms, stair lifts, showers, or whatever vulnerable people need to stay independent. First, an occupational therapist visits to assess the tenant's need and reports back to a special office in the council housing department. Then, a surveyor visits the property and decides how to do the work. Lastly, workmen arrive to do the conversion. The three-stage process need not take longer than a couple of weeks. The council's independent living service manage and pay for the process, but now it appears decisions are being put off for longer and longer to save cash, and the elderly and vulnerable are simply being left in an entirely inadequate housing. Some vulnerable people have simply been forced to move or pay for conversions out of their own pocket. John and Malcolm McNamara live in council accommodation in Westbury. John is seriously ill and almost permanently on oxygen. He can no longer use the bath in his flat because if he could manage to get in, he probably could not get out again. He and his carer brother say Bristol City Council's independent living service have been penny-pinching, putting delays of years on their desperately needed shower conversion. And they say they're not the only ones who've been put at risk.
My name's John McNamara. 26 Clover Ground, Westbury, Bristol. My bathroom, I cannot use the bath whatsoever, and I'm having to wait till June or July this year for to see the surveyor, and possibly another 3 months after that.
Now, you're on oxygen. Can you tell us about your medical state?
I've got COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Yeah, I'm on oxygen, and the minimum I can be on there is 17 hours a day. I'm told by the respiratory nurse I should be on there more. I'm all right when I'm walking about inside my home, but I can't get into this bath. No way, I can't bend or anything like that. And when I'm outside, I can't walk very far. I can't walk more than 60 foot, something like that, without getting short on breath.
Well, what was to happen if you would get into the bath?
Yeah, I would get extremely difficult getting in. In fact, I haven't been able to use the bath at all since I've been in here in 2008. I'm afraid to get into it, or even attempt to get into it. And when the occupational therapist was here, he tested me, and he said, "This is a waste of time when you have in the bath here. You need a shower." I told him that my brother, who's also my carer, does the cooking, does the shopping, and also helps me with a sit-down wash, doing washing.
So when did you first ask the council if you could have a shower?
August, early August 2008. I then waited till the first letter I got off the council was September 22nd, and that told me I was on the list. I then had to wait 9 months for the occupational therapist, and then I've got to wait till June or July this year before a surveyor comes out, and then possibly anything to 3 months after that, or so I've been told, led to believe anyway. I'll believe it when it happens.
My name is Malcolm McNamara. I'm John's brother. I'm slightly younger, about 5 or 6 years younger. And the problem is that John asked for a shower, and they said no. Well, they actually said yes, but it's going to take over 2 years to do it. Whilst I live in sheltered accommodation myself, and well, it's a housing association, but a housing association managed to get it done within 6 months. And when I looked at it, I did ask how it was done and who paid for it, and I was told it was done under a disabled facilities grant, which seems to me all wrong. That if somebody lives in a housing association property, they can get it done in 6 months, where a council tenant has got to wait over 2.5 years just before a surveyor arrives.
Now, you were a bit suspicious about what the council were up to, quite rightly, and you put in a Freedom of Information request, didn't you? Can you tell us how you did that?
Well, originally, we went through the entire council complaints procedure, which you've got to apply 3 times, and it sort of gradually works its way up the chain. And it finally reached a corporate complaints manager, Tim Shepherd, his name is, and he wrote back to us and said, "We've gone through the system, we can't do anything, virtually we've got to go to the Ombudsman. So we thought, well, if we go to the Ombudsman, well, we're going to need some sort of evidence. So we had a small report from the occupational therapist that the council sent us. So we thought we'd see the full one. So we applied to the council under the Freedom of Information Act, for which they charged us £10, and applied for the full report, which we've now got.
Now, one of the things it says as part of the full assessment into your brother's needs is that the level of risk to your brother is substantial.
We first applied to the council to have his priority changed. The council says he's a standard priority, whereas the occupational therapist has told us it's substantial. The council also told us that the occupational therapist set the level of priority. Well, obviously, from the Freedom of Information Act, the occupational therapist report, it says substantial, it doesn't say standard. So our guess is that they're trying to last out the 2 years, or 2.5 years, which it's got something to do with the budget.
Now, why do you think it's different at the council than it is at the housing association where you live?
Well, a housing association, you can get a thing called a disabilities facilities grant for fitting things like level access showers, and it's a mandatory requirement that the local council has got to pay it, whereas they're forced to pay it to an outside association, but for their own tenants they can just drag their feet and take their time as long as they like.
Now, with the information you got from your Freedom of Information request, it clearly says here level of risk is substantial. How do you think that they can possibly justify now saying that it's a, you know, reducing that down to a standard assessment level of risk?
Well, I've got no idea. Leroy Bain, who was the occupational therapist, his report says substantial. We've had a letter from the council saying that his report says he's standard. So obviously someone hasn't read the report properly, or they're just, like I said before, just trying to take their time to reduce their budget for this. Well, I say financial year, but it's over 2 years now.
Like, I've got my brother here. My brother is there. He's acting as my carer, unpaid. And I rely on him for doing the shopping, helping me bathing, taking me to the doctors.
Malcolm, just what do you think that your experience here tells us about what the council are up to?
Good question. I wish I could tell you. Like my brother just said in the bank, I think they've lost the plot. They're using any excuse they possibly can not to spend their budget. They've not put enough aside to cover their budget. They're saying that it takes 2.5 years to send a surveyor around. It makes me wonder what the waiting list is and how you get to be a high priority. You'd have to be nearly dead to be a high priority. During the course of the 2 years we've been complaining and trying to speak the council up, we had occasion to contact Councillor Jenny Smith, who's actually on the Bristol City Council, and at the moment she's investigating several other cases that have been taking just as long. In fact, there's a lady who we was told about who lives in Southmead. She was having a bath and she couldn't get out. She was actually stranded there for 2 or 3 hours sitting in cold water, and she's been waiting as long as my brother.
Now, Mary, this is a sorry case. Surely the money spent on the 3 cycles of complaints by the council, you know, replying to all these complaints, and the Chief Executive Jan Omeroyd's office getting involved too, this is surely a false economy, because the money spent so far by the Chief Executive's office and the council fighting the complaint surely would have paid for John's shower.
Well, it does seem like that, and you know, in some way, you're quite right. But as he said, that he's not the only one. There are a large number, and the council has to prioritise some things in some order. Without going into the details of the case, which we've heard his side, but we haven't heard other people's in the similar.
Well, I mean, I've seen the documents, and clearly when the occupational therapist came round, he said it was a high priority, but a substantial priority, and the council have recategorised that as a standard priority. Yes. Now, that does sound a little bit dodgy, doesn't it?
Well, yes, on the face of it, it does.
I mean, what's the point in bringing in an independent person if you're then going to go and say, oh, actually, we're going to change it?
I don't know that the occupational therapist is sort of the expert, but I expect she is a city council employee. Yes. But, you know, unfortunately, the adult social care budget is very, very stretched, and and they're nearly always in a sort of overspend state.
Don't you think maybe the council could take some of the money it spends on public relations, on these kind of things that they send through our door every week to tell us how wonderful they are, and spend a bit more on adult care?
Well, they do spend, an enormous proportion of the budget does go on adult care. It is one of the it is the major thing, and they, you know, and in some ways they also like to keep people. I mean, you don't get one every week, but they have to keep the rest of the population of Bristol informed about things as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's a kind of populist point. Let's cut the PR budgets. Yes. To I mean, the amount of money spent on adult care will dwarf the PR budget for sure. What really is the problem with our society as a whole is, have we got our priorities right?
Yes.
I mean, the council has to work within a budget which is inadequate to the task which it's been asked to do. And that, and also, there may be some bureaucratic problems with this particular case. I mean, this, and of course, Jenny has taken it up as the councillor for the area, and that's as it should be. That's what the councillor is there for, is to get things done for people if they can. But fundamentally, we need to ask ourselves what is wrong with our society. When there's, I mean, somebody in that position isn't going to be around much longer, and therefore, you know, doing it late is worse than not doing it at all. I mean, we ought to put the quality of people's lives, their health, their welfare at the heart of everything we do, and we seem to have forgotten all of this. And I don't actually agree with the idea that we should be cutting budgets like this at all.
What do you think?
Well, no, I agree. As far as the adults' social care, I mean, we've got an ageing population, and, you know, in fact, those budgets, willy-nilly, are going to have to increase over the next few years.
Yeah, and can I make the point? You want to actually stimulate the economy. The economy is falling down a cliff, so you need to spend some money on something. Why not on things like this? We've got to break this thinking whereby, oh, we've got a crisis, so we've got to cut back. Now, if everybody cuts back, the economy will collapse. It's a basic lesson that was learned in the 30s and the 40s, but it's been forgotten. And if we go through into the next phase, cutting back on essential things like this, it'll cause misery, and B, it's just silly because it'll make the economy go. If you spend money on things like this, some shower manufacturer is actually going to make some money, aren't they? And somebody, that's how you do it.
Maybe. Do you think that message is going to filter down to the Bristol City Council's independent living service, Mary?
Well, I suspect they're only too aware of it, but they are just desperately trying to juggle their budgets and keep things in.
Because this is a kind of demographic time bomb, isn't it? It's been talked about.
It is.
Because we've got a massively ageing population.
Yes.
And there was even talk earlier this year, we talked about on this show, of closing some of the residential care homes.
Yes, but the whole drive at the moment is to keep, is in fact to do these aids and adaptations and keep people in their homes, their own homes, much longer. But, you know, rather than put them in residential care, and, you know, generally speaking, you know, a few aids and adaptations are less costly than having people in residential care.
What you might think about doing is paying the brother as well.
Yes.
There are plenty of good things that we could be doing, and I think we ought to be thinking about the things we want and need rather than can we afford things.
Yes, yeah. I certainly think he should be putting in for an attendance allowance, because it sounds, you know, from what we've heard today, it sounds as though, you know, he would be entitled to it.
Okay, well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Chair of Bristol City Council Licensing Committee and Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Mary Sykes. So, Mary, I think you're standing down at this election, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'm.
Why is that? Have you been...
well, because I'm getting to one of these ageing members of the population. So, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Who will be standing for the Liberals in that ward?
Well, we have a very good person who has been a councillor in other parts of the country. Her name is Sylvia Dubell, and I sincerely hope that voters in Hengrove will put their faith in her and send her back to the City Council in my place.
Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, it's Good Friday, so we won't be dragging a local politician in. What we'll be doing instead, Martin and I have a music special for you with some choice samples included with the music of last week's or this week's or next week's internet radio from around the world. After the 6 o'clock news, Dr. Alan Zabrowski is an ex-senior US Marine Corps officer and the retired head of studies at the US Army's War College. He has been on the radio in the United States this week saying that the Israeli Mossad carried out the 9/11 attacks. So what exactly did he say and why? Then we take a look at the Irish Troubles and collusion between secretive units in the British Army with loyalist terrorists. And is our economic and military crisis part of a push for world government? Join us after the news.
Here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.